there are two primary stages, namely the zrika, the sprinkling of the blood upon the altar, and also the burning of the prohibited fat upon the altar. Okay, the chelev. And the question is, you know, whether a person who happens to be slaughtering for Avodah Zarah, so whether in that particular case the same principle applies, first of all, Nechash B'Nyavid Avodah, as Rabbi Yochanan says, namely that if you have already a bad thought as you go from one to the other, so it's no good, right? And also you learn the parallel from the Beis HaMikdash, where, as we said, that if you have the wrong idea in mind, then in that particular case it also cancels out the sacrifice. But Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, it should be, Omar Muteris, he says that it is permitted. So Omar Lei, Tamin Choshatro, he says, well, you should have a good show, he says, if you say, when did he finally get the idea of that it's going to dedicate to Avodah Zarah, it was at the very moment of completion that it happened. But if he didn't have it before, then there may be grounds, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, to permit it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Are we talking about it? I'm confused about who's doing the shechet thing. We're talking about a kosher shechet.
Could be anybody. Could be a goy also.
Could shechet. Be anybody.
Right. Remember, what is the problem? The problem is about the rennet that comes from the stomach or the maw,
right,
whatever it may be. Okay.
Okay? So the concern
that's
about
the problem.
This animal that
right.
The rennet is going to come from.
Right.
So
yeah, but that's going to make a trafe anyway. It's not permitted to make the cheese out of the rennet.
Okay. Could also lead to another problem that we really didn't discuss very much. But if you remember, the Mishnah indicated not only is it prohibited for eating, but it's also prohibited for hanah, in other words, to sell it or something like that, make it, you know. So, in that particular case, you know, with Avodah Zarah, the rule would be stricter than it would be for treif. Understand? If you have a piece of meat that becomes prey for whatever reason it may be, obviously you can't eat it. But could you give it to a goy? The answer is yes.
So
could you sell it to a goy? The answer is yes.
So the word they use is benefit.
Right, right. So in this particular case, we would say that at least hanor, at least benefit you can get out of it.
You can get benefit out of it even if it's going to be used for the Avodah Zarah?
Well, that's the question. That is the question. One says no, the other one says yes.
Okay. So now I have another question. We're talking about burning the fat and sprinkling the blood.
Right.
And we know that that's what goes on in the temple service. Are you telling me that the same procedure was done in the Avodah Zarah?
Apparently it was. Because otherwise, why would they make this question of the Yalm Finan, you know, that you learn from, you know, what goes on in the Beis HaMikdash. From that you can understand what goes on when they sacrifice all
this. So my question, it's funny, I feel funny even thinking about it. And so what I'm thinking is, if it was done that way in the Avodah Zarah, it was done that way first.
You mean the question, which came first?
Which came first, the temple service or the Avodah Zarah type? No. With the temple service, we're told
in
the Torah.
Yeah, we have to say that in general, obviously, the non-Jews were sacrificing before the Jews finally
that's
got around
right.
to it.
So
I can't say that...
That's a very strange thought, you know, that the same service, that they would copy the other... But it's not so much copy, it's literally written in the Torah how to do it.
If you live in a certain societal niche and time, you wouldn't introduce something, new service to people who would not understand that they have to speak the same language. okay, if people do sacrifices, okay, but we got the rules how to live properly. No, isn't it the case that when Mashiach comes, whether the temple avoided will be restored, plus Man Hazeh, because Gentiles no longer do sacrifices? So.
Yeah, well, this is... It's a big question, you know, what happens. Needless to say that the, what shall I say, the stringent opinion, okay, is that if we rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, then also we'll have to reinstitute the sacrificial system, okay? There are those who say, however, that just as it required the prophets to introduce the sacrifices back in the days when the people of Israel were in their infancy, so likewise we would have to have a prophet in our own day who authorize the restoration of sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash. But that's a big problem, no question about it. No.
Our procedure is very specific depending on the different types of sacrifice. First of all, we use our mazbeah, our altar, okay? And it depends. Sometimes sprinkle at the corners and then throw the rest of the blood, which has to be the bottom half.
Yeah, correct.
So we don't know that the Romans did things exactly the same way.
So it's an accommodation to the times, but unique to what we were doing at the
temple.
Certainly, I can't give a 100% answer to something like that. Even the Rambam, you know, he had two different opinions. In one, in the Yad Chazakah, you know, this great companion of Jewish law, he goes into all the details of sacrifice and this and that and so on, all the different things that we find in the Torah, you know, in the Talmud, you know, and he codifies it, okay? And of course, on the contrary, first of all, you know, the codes of Jewish law that followed, they concentrated only upon those things that they felt were practical for the kind of life that they're living today. The Shulchan Aruch, you know, whether it was the Torah of the Aruch, or the Shulchan Aruch of Yossi Karo, or some of the other codes, even up to the, let's say the Mishnah Berura in our own time, or the Aruch HaShulchan. These are codes of Jewish law, okay, but they don't contain anything pertaining to sacrifices, okay? And on the other hand, philosophically, the Rambam felt that even though it was necessary to have sacrifice the Beis HaMikdash and so on, but he says it was a concession to the thoughts of the day. That if Moshe Rabbeinu were to say that, you know, there's no such thing as sacrifice necessary, they never would have accepted it, because wherever they lived, the idea of sacrifice, you know, was common. That was the way people worshipped.
But they took it and they sanctified it, and they specified, like you said, particular
right, correct, yeah.
When you think about it, I mean, how Judaism was able to transform itself here. Sacrifice was a prominent element to faith of prayer, avoda, and study.
Exactly.
And it's a miracle. I mean, when you think about it, it almost seems like a miracle that a people who were in a different culture with sacrifices all around them were able to transform themselves to continue Judaism the way it was. Because it was so different. It was made such a major turn in our religion.
Right.
After the temple was destroyed, the fact that our religion survived
sacrifice themselves, you know, they were two minds about sacrifice. Essentially, I would say that their point of view was that they accepted sacrifice as a way of worshiping God, but they did not accept sacrifice as an automatic gesture. Rather, it has to lead, you know, to a holy life, to a dedicated life. You see. That's the difference.
It was also limited in terms of place.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they could, wherever they wanted to, they could
fire, that's one of the things, right.
But it was limited, very...
Right. Once the base of Mikdash was built, then sacrifice could take place only in the base of Mikdash.
Right.
Right.
So it was limited as a place.
Right.
So already you see almost the stages that the people went through.
Right.
Yeah,
but didn't they have to invoke templates? Didn't they, you know, they went away from them? And they came back?
Yeah, when they came back, they rebuilt,
they rebuilt
the Beis HaMikdash and reinstituted the sacrificial system.
They had a place to do it.
Right.
But presumably, they didn't do it then.
No.
Presumably, between the time of the two temples,
right,
there was no sacrifice.
But in Babylonia, people would gather in order to listen to the prophets. They would gather in order to recite prayers. So that there's no question that the synagogue assumed an even more important role in Babylonia.
Wasn't there one prophet that said, what does God need?
You
sacrifice?
Yeah, of course. Yeshayahu, we read it. You read it in the Haftorah. We'll read it this year. It's going to be Erev Tisha B'Av, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, the first chapter of Yeshayahu, where he says, why do I need this multitude of sacrifices? Right? But rather, you know, you should do justice and so on.
Yeah.
Right.
And Ezra, right. Am I wrong? Wasn't it Ezra that had influence in terms of developing the communal prayer type of thing, the synagogue?
Well, this we find with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people, you know, they were organized originally by Ezra. The Chabian people came back from Babylonian captivity, and they made some very important rulings in Jewish life.
So what you're all saying is really important. What you're saying is that the difference between the Greeks and the Romans and the Jews is that the Greeks and the Romans found meaning in the sacrifice itself. If you did that, it was enough. You appreciated the gods, that was it. But here, what you're saying is that the sacrifice, Isaiah says, is in effect, the sacrifice by itself is just a starting point. Right? You have to have it signed. That's not the deep part.
Right.
You have to have a sense of compassion to the deeds.
Right.
And,
right. Find the same thing in telling me. Right.
Elevated in
right.
your life.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that, the sacrifice is meaningless. So that's a very big difference also.
Right.
Conception of it. Yeah, I think that's what you're saying.
Until we find the same idea repeated, and not just, you know, in Yeshayahu and other the prophets as well, but also in Tillim. One of the Psalms says, even though some of the Psalms speak in praise, you know, but here is one of the verses in Tillim that says, the Ben Ishlam says, what do I need? Zebach Theatata, what do I need? Sacrifices and gifts that you give to me. Says, what God wants is a heart which is broken and contrite. This is what he wants.
Which is what?
Broken and contrite.
Or broken and contrite.
Right, right. So we see that the emphasis is really upon what is the spiritual meaning behind it, because that should be our guide. No. Pray for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. What will be when it's rebuilt, we'll have to wait and see. Okay. So, all right. Let's do a little bit more over here on the page and we'll call it a night. Omar Rab Yehuda, Shal Rab Yishmael, etc., etc. He wanted to know, you know, really questions about the cheese. Why do they permit, you know, the use of rennet, non-kosher animals? Okay. So, Omar Rav Yudal Mishra, he says, Omar Rav Ach the boy, Omar Rav, Rav Achterboy said in the name of Rav, he says, HaMekadesh Beferish Shor Hadisko Nikudeshes, but Beferish Egli Avedes Kechodim Einam Bukudeshes. You're going to be shocked by the translation. Perish is, you know, what the animal excretes. Okay. All right. So he says that if a person wants to use this in order to be Mekadesh a woman. Okay. Now I have to explain to you. Today, when we have a marriage ceremony, we really are combining two different steps into one. First is called Kiddushin, or Erusin, wherein the betrothal takes place. What do I mean by betrothal? The man says to the woman, you are Mekudeshesli, right? Okay. Literally, you were sanctified
right?
to me.
Right. The signing of the
Tanoim. The Tanoim even precedes that, okay?
Oh.
Tanoim precedes. I'm talking about the marriage ceremony itself.
Yes.
Right. Notice, there are always the two different sets of brachas, each of them preceded by the bracha for wine. So the first one is the Kedushin or Erusin, but I don't term you want to use that. They're synonymous, okay? Well, he says, "Harei at bekudesh asli," or the Lashon de Gemara. He could also say, "Harei at bu restlessly." It's the same thing. Meaning is the same. So that automatically, if she accepts, then she becomes designated as his wife. The next part, after the reading of Ksuba, where you lay out, you know, what how much has been promised and this and that, and the fact that the woman, you know, in case of death or divorce and so on, how much she's going to receive from the estate of her husband. Of course, he also makes a promise that he's going to cherish her, work for her, provide her with clothing and housing, etc., etc. Okay? This is all part of the promise that the husband has to make of the ksuba. Okay? So, at any rate, then it is followed by seven brachas, which we can call the Sheva brachas if you wish. Or by its technical name, it's Birchos Nisuin. In other words, these are the marital blessings, okay? Wherein we pray, you know, thanking God for having instituted marriage between man and wife, and so on. And, you know, comparing their existence to that of Adam and Eve in Gan Eden, okay? That the bride and groom should have a life like Adam and Eve. They were alone for each other, right? All alone in the world. So this is the feeling they should have. Okay. So in order to effect Kiddushin, the man has to give the woman something of value. Okay? The Gemara in Kiddushin, you know, it speaks about the fact, also Ksubis, and so, you know, that they all have to deal with marriage laws, okay? That it has to be at least Shavet Pruta. It has to be at least the value of a Pruta. Which
what?
In those days, a Pruta. There was a certain coin that they used in those days. It has to be at least that valuable. If it's less than that, it would be considered an insult to a Jewish woman, you know, to offer that. Okay, what we do today, of course, I don't know if you've ever seen it or heard it, but for example, the ring that the groom gives to the bride, so you have Adam, you have witnesses standing under the hoop over there watching the proceedings, and usually the Masonic Kedushin, the rabbi who is conducting the ceremony, he takes the ring, you know, from the groom, and he shows it to the witnesses, and he asks them, Shavet Pruta? And they answer, yeah, Shavet Pruta. It's worth at least that. Okay. So that is the object, you know, that has value that he gives them. In ancient days, there could be any object of value. If he wanted to do it with a wristwatch instead of a ring, It's perfectly legal according to Jewish law. Of course, wristwatches also have a value, okay? And back in the old days when people were very poor, if he gave her a spoon, for example, which had the value of that, or something like that, you understand? So here, as I said, the shocking part is that if he says, I am giving you the excreta of or the excrement, whatever you want to say, of a shor hanisko, which I'll explain in a second, then if she accepts it as being a thing of value, then in that case she is the Kadesha, she is officially married to him. Okay.
Maybe she has a garden.
Huh?
Maybe she has a garden.
Could be, right.
That would be valuable in a
absolutely,
garden.
Yes.
Right,
yeah. Right. So, what is the Shor Hanisko? We have a rule in the Bible that, you know, if a ox gores people, has been watched, so after the goring three different people, at this particular point, the animal has to be put to death.
Yeah.
How do they put it to death? They had a bez in, and then they stoned the animal. That's called Shor Hanisko. Now, the Shor Hanisko, you're not allowed to derive any benefit from it. And yet, what does he say over here? That the perish, in other words, what separates, what comes out of it, it's no longer to be considered part of the animal. And so therefore, that has some value, and the woman would be Nikudeshes, okay? On the other hand, if it was perish, you know, the excrement of Egli Avida Zora, of calves that were used for idolatry, then in that particular case, Eina Mekudeshes, she is not betrothed. Why? Because when it comes to Avida Zora, we have to say that you cannot derive any benefit whatsoever from it, even from what, you know, comes out of that particular animal. So I think we'll stop at this point.
Okay.
And,
Rabbi,
okay, tonight is the 10th of August of the year 2005, and we're continuing at the bottom of Avodah Zarah Daf Lamed Daled Omid Beis. In other words, Avodah Zarah 34b towards the bottom over there, with the discussion now about the cheese. But before we start with cheese, we start with this din that we were talking about why did Rav, quoted by Rav Achtavoy, say that if the woman was willing to accept the perish, as we said, you know, anything that's excreted, okay, by the animal, and this animal happened to be a Shor Hanisko, then it would still be a value. Whereas, if it were from a calf which was dedicated to Avodah Zarah, then in that case, it would not be. So they want to find out why. All right. So he says, Eboys Amor, if you wish, you can say, Svara. We can figure it out that there's a logical reason. Okay? The Eboys Amor, that's what that next abbreviation over there. And if you wish, you can say, Kra, that you can derive this by a study of the wording in the Torah. Okay? So, here goes. Eboy Sebo Sevora, if we say that we could derive the difference between the perish of the animal which, you know, the Shor Hanisko, the ox, which was stoned because of the fact that, you know, it had killed one person after another.
Boy,
okay?
Yeah.
And why is, you know, the perish, the excrement of that, acceptable, right? Whereas, in the case of the, you know, the calf of Avodah Zarah, it was not acceptable. So what is the svara? What is the logic? So he says, okay, logically I can think about as follows, okay? He says,
good evening,
welcome. He says, in the case of Egli Avodah Kochavim, right? In that particular case, then okay, the Nichalei B'Nafchei, which means that the calf, if it's going to be sacrificed to Avodah Zarah, the more weight it has, literally, the more it's swollen. This is what the root, the letters, you know, Nafchei means. The more it is swollen, the more weight it has upon it. In other words, the fatter the animal it is, then in that particular case, it is more acceptable as an offering to the Avodah Zarah. In other words, they don't want to give you, if you're sacrificing to Avodah Zarah, you don't want to give them skinny calves. They want fat calves over there, okay? So therefore, the excrement within the calf, right, makes it that much bigger. So that therefore, he's happy, you know, to keep the excrement over there because he's sacrificing a fatter animal to Avodah Zarah, okay? Whereas, in the case of Gabi Sharon Iskol, in the case of the ox which was stoned, Lo Nechole B'Nafchei, he doesn't care about the excrement of it because the Sharon Iskol, what difference does it make whether it's fat or not? I mean, that's not the thing. Why is it stoned? Not because it's fat.
It's stoned,
right? No. The Sharon Iskol. It's stoned because it killed. And so therefore, in that particular case, so the parish doesn't mean anything to the person who owns the Sharon Iskol. And if that's the case, then in that particular case, we can consider it a separate entity from the actual cow itself or the ox itself. So this is the reasoning. So as I say, this is reasoning. If, on the other hand, you're looking for a posek to justify the difference between the Sharon Iskol and the Avodah Zarah animal, right? Well, here you have a posek also. Emakro, Ibois Emakro. All right, let's take a look at the posek. Ksiv Hocho, right? In the case of an animal which is sacrificed for Avodah Zarah. So what does it say? It says, Lo yidbak biyotcha mi'uma, right? Nothing should cling in your hand from this animal. It's biyotcha mi'uma min acherub. The acherub means that the animal is no good. It's dedicated, to an evil purpose, etc., etc. So that you should not have anything to do with it. If you should not have anything to do with me, you're not allowed to have any hanorah from it. Remember? The idea that you gain some advantage by it. What was the advantage before? The advantage up above is, according to Rav, that it could be used in order to be Mekadosh a woman, right? To betroth her. Okay. But with this, absolutely not. Because nothing, no hanor whatever must be derived from an animal dedicated to Avodah Zarah. Usiv Hosom, and in the case of the Sharon Iskol, what is written over there? So it says, Soko Yisokel Hashor, Velo Yeochel Es Besorah. The Pasuk says, the ox must be stoned, right? And its flesh may not be eaten.
Right.
Okay? The soriosa. So, this is what we're putting the stress on. Its flesh is prohibited. But her torsho, pirsho, or taras, however whatever excrement comes out of it would be permitted. Okay? So, as I said a moment ago, the idea of perish, while it means excrement, and usually, you know, we associate it with the idea of, you know, cow flop or whatever it may be, I mean, which is used for fertilization as well, but it may also be interpreted as any secretion internally. Actually, what secretion are we talking about?
Cow manure is a very valuable product. It's
sold today. It is. Right.
It's sold today for fertilizer and many other things.
This is true. Right.
For fuel
also, I think that was done. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Not only that, but we've already seen the word Galilee Bokar, which we find in Isaiah, for example. Okay, what are they? That we learned are vessels that were made out of hardened manure. Okay?
Yeah.
Right. And we said that such vessels, just like vessels of stone, are not mekabel tuma. They will not ever become tomei, you know, the ritual sense. Okay? So, okay. Omar Rabbah. So, Rabbah said, Tarvaihu Tadanhe. Says, you know what? Tarvaihu means both of them. It's the third line from the bottom.
But I don't understand.
Yeah.
Flesh is prohibited, right?
Correct.
Why is it waste acceptable?
Because we say that the perish is independent of the flesh. This is the argument that Rav is putting forth. Needless to say, there are other authorities that we're going to be quoting now in reference to the Rennet. I mean, this is the whole thing that got started over here. The Rennet, that, you know, is it actually affected by the meat in which it is, or is it independent of it? You understand? I mean, there are many questions about it. I mean, this is part of the whole problem of, you know, the cheese, which is not made, you know, under kosher supervision.
Right.
Okay? And in addition to which, of course, you know, here, what's involved in our text is also the problem of Avodah Zarah that comes in as well.
Right.
Where, what did we learn? In the case of Avodah Zarah, you cannot derive any benefit whatever from it. Whereas, as we saw in the case of the Shorah Niskol, which is prohibited to be eaten, but nevertheless, a benefit could be derived from it. Okay. So, on the third line, now from the bottom, Omer Rava, so Rava said, Tarvaihu Tinanhu. Okay. We have already learned this in another context. Both of them.
Right.
Both of these things. Tarvayu. Tarvayu means both of them. Tidanhe. We have learned it. Mm-hmm. What have we learned? Mitzika omale, inasmuch as what did the Tana say to the other one? He said, Vipnei Shema Midin Bekevas the Vela. It says, why do we prohibit the cheese of a goy, right? Here we're not even talking about Avodah Zarah at this point. You understand? We're not talking about Avodah Zarah now. Forget the Avodah Zarah for the moment. But we learned that the reason why we prohibit their cheese is because they keep it, that is, you know, the milk which is going to be used for making cheese is kept in kevas nevela. The, if you want to translate it as more, or the stomach, or something like that, it's really the stomach, right, of an animal which is treif. Nevela here is like a synonym for the word treif, and the treif animal, okay? They call mahadirle, but nevertheless, the other one answered him in the discussion. Right? The halo kivas illa chabur bekevas nevela. He says, wait a minute, he says, didn't we learn that the more of a a burnt offering, an olah, has an even stricter prohibition than that of a treifa animal. Okay. Next, yes.
Are they saying that you're trying to say that the rennet is from a non-kosher animal? What if the rennet is from a kosher animal, like a cow?
Right.
It's clearly a kosher animal.
Correct. It would be permitted if it were slaughtered and so on. This is the general view. Okay. Of course, again, it goes back to the fact that there is an argument. Is it affected or is it not affected? You understand? Is it a prohibition of basar v'chalav, meat and milk, or do we say that it's independent and it doesn't absorb from the meat? That the meat is only, I don't know, like an enzyme, but it's not, it's not really entering into the milk itself, which curdles and becomes cheese. This is the question.
Interesting, because now on the kosher cheese, they're trying to market it as being vegetarian.
Right. Today the emphasis, right.
From a meat source.
Yes, yes. I saw that in the Stop and Shop. They're selling a
type of
cheese.
No, the cheese, they're trying to sell it as also a vegetarian.
Correct.
Because the rennet is a chemical mixture, not from an animal.
Right. Actually, they can make it. They can make from vegetable too. They can derive rennet these days. I mean, chemically they can.
Why don't we question milk from a cow? I mean, here there's milk from a cow.
You're 100% right. The question is, is it independent or not? It's perish in that sense too. I mean, it's a secretion which once it comes out, it has no connection anymore with the other one. That's correct. So as we see, how these things are being worked out. Okay, next page. Okay. Okay, yeah, so we are continuing now on Lamed Hey Amad Aleph. All right, so the Klal, it says, from this we can learn what? We can learn that the Isurei HaNor show Parashah. All right, that even though we're not allowed to have benefit, in the sense we can't eat it, you understand? Talking about the nevela, are we permitted to eat a treifa animal? No, not allowed to. Nevertheless, there is a certain hanor that is permissible. Mm-hmm. Namely, they permitted the perish. In this case, it's plural, parshayhu, which means not just, what I said before, but here now we're talking about the internal secretions of the animal itself. And from the argument that he gave him, right? The reason that we prohibit it is because they put it into the more stomach, or whatever you want to say, or that using the rennet of calves that have been sacrificed, to idolatry. And then the other one said to him in reply, he said, wait a minute. He says, Im Cain, Lomo Aseruha Ba'anon. Right? So, in that case, then why didn't they prohibit it? In other words, in the case of the Nevela, Niklal, from this we learn what? Avedas Kechobim, also Purushayu. Right? This we see that in the case of an animal that has been dedicated to Avodah Zarah, so whatever secretions come out of it are prohibited. Well, so maybe he could have answered him the following argument. He says, Mishum delay se le yisura be'enei. He could have argued as follows. But look, you cannot see the prohibition in its original form. What do we mean in its original form? Well, it would mean, for example, that we can't see that the milk in the stomach is something like that. That, you know, is this the way it was originally or not, and so on. The ene or the ayin, the eno, usually means exactly in the way it was before. Okay? And here we can't be in such a condition that you see it exactly the way it was before, because it's already undergone changes. Okay? And it's like the Morias, and they give an example again in the Morias. The Rabbanon write that the rabbis, the law seruha ba'adah, the rabbis did not prohibit any deriving any kind of benefit from it. Remember, we learned before about the Morias, right? Remember, you know, the fish. That maybe they would add Yay Nesach to it. And we argue that, as a general rule, if a manufacturer who manufactures Morias, we said he's not going to add because he knows he's going to lose his business, okay? And that there was the argument, you know, if it goes along from a place, you know, where wine is more expensive. So we learned that they're not going to take the trouble to put wine into it because it costs so much more than the Morias, okay? And then there was another argument, you know, maybe it came down the coast and it came to an area where, Tyre to be exact, the right sort, where the cost of wine is the same as by us. And nevertheless, they were not afraid of that either because it says there were whirlpools over there. The water is too rough. They're not going to go into that area because they're afraid that the cargo will spoil itself. So they gave permission, as we saw, to have Morias and not to be concerned about the wine because they didn't think there would be added to it. Alright, so now he's saying, okay, so look, the rabbis permitted Morias, right? They never prohibited it in Hanah. So my Tama, why? La Mishum Deleisa Yisura Be'enai. Isn't it because once everything is mixed together, then you cannot find a source, you know, which would be a prohibition in its original state. In other words, let's say that somebody added a drop of wine to it. You wouldn't be able to find the wine because it's no longer there in its original state. So therefore, what is his argument? His argument wants to show that what? That the cheese should be okay because of the fact that what? That the milk is no longer milk. What is it now? It's cheese. You understand? It's no longer right. Right. This is what the argument is. Okay. So Amre, Hocha came in the Ukmer, Kamokim, Hoshim Lakim, and the Yisem Yisurbi. Okay, in this particular case, inasmuch as they keep it for a while, so you could get the impression as if it were still in its original state. So then the Mishnah says that he decided to change the argument altogether. He moved them off. He made them travel to something else. That's what the Mishnah said. Didn't want to argue this business further at this moment. And what did he talk about? So he quotes him a pasuk from Shir HaShir, right? And the question is, since, you know, to begin with, if you would take a look at the scroll in which Shir HaShirim is written, it's one of the five Megillahs, you know, we read it on Pesach, okay? Take a look at the scroll, do we have any voweling over there? Of course not. So, if you see the word, Dalad, Vav, Dalad, Yud, Lager Chof, okay? Chof Sofit. You could either read it as Dodecha or Dodayach. You could read it either way, okay? So, that being the case, we learned that Shir HaShirim represents the relationship between the Rebbeinu Shel Olam and the people of Israel. And the relationship is portrayed as a husband and a wife, so to speak. Okay? So the prophets will occasionally also use a similar example. As for example, Yeshayahu, when he says, you know, the Zion will be meeting against the Haftorah in another few weeks, among these Haftorahs of consolation, where he says, Eizu Sefer Krisus Imchem. Show me, Isaiah says, to the people of Israel, where is the bill of divorce that Hashem gave to your mother? In other words, did God ever divorce himself from the people of Israel? He never did. You understand? So that this is the relationship between God and people. So, when it says, Ki tovim dodecha miyayin, I mean, this is the way we read it, okay? But it could also mean Ki tovim dodayach miyayin, okay? So, if I read it the way it is, Ki tovim dodecha, okay? And, on the other hand, if we read it as dodayach, then it means that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is saying to the people of Israel that your love for me is more precious than mine. So it all depends which way you read it. You read it one way or another. So he says, well, we can figure that one out, right? Why? So he raised the question. He didn't give an answer. But the Gemara now says, Ki Osa Rav Dimi, when Rav Dimi came, whenever it says Ki Osa Rav Dimi, it means that when he came to Babylonia from Eretz Yisrael, where this matter was discussed in the schools and the academies in Eretz Yisrael, so he says, Omar, he said, Omra Knesset Yisrael Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It says, the assembly of the people of Israel, meaning the people, the Jewish people, okay? But notice the word, Knesset Yisrael, we use this very, very often in speaking about the Jews as a whole, Jewish people, okay? And of course, we know, how do we say a synagogue? It's a Beit Knesset, you know what I mean? This is it, you see. So, people of Israel say to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, to our Kodesh Baruch Hu, they say, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, Aravim Olai Divrei Dodecha Yosef Miyinu Shel Torah. Very interesting comment that was made on this. It says, the words of Dodecha, namely those who love you, the words that they utter are even more, even sweeter unto me than the Yeno Shel Torah, okay, than the wine of the Torah. In other words, what are the people of Israel saying? What they are saying is, according to one interpretation over here, is that the teachings of our sages, our rabbis, are even more precious than the actual word in the Torah, because in the final analysis, what are they doing? They're interpreting the Torah, you see, so that we gain a greater insight
so we can understand it.
Right, so we can understand it better. So he says, Ma Ishna Haiko Shailei. So I say, for what reason is it this particular pasuk that the question is raised? So Amar Abshim Ben Pazi, from Shim Miswazi says, the Itema, it wasn't Shim Ben Pazi, but it was from Shim Ben Barami. He says, May Reshe the Kruat. You can figure it out from what preceded Ki Tovim Dodecha Miyayin. how I should read it. Why? Because it's written over there, Yisho Keni, may he kiss me, literally, Minashikos Pito, with the kisses of his mouth. Okay? In other words, may God show, you know, his love for us as a man shows love, you know, for his woman. Okay? So, Amale. So he said unto him, Yishmael Ochi. Brother Yishmael, he says, Chashok Sipsosecha, Zu Bzu, says, you should clamp your lips to each other, the altivahil hoshiv, and don't be in such a hurry to come back with an answer. Okay. Now what is he referring to over here? Now it has nothing to do with the pasuk that we're talking about. What are we talking about right now that he tells them to be quiet? Not to be hasty in coming to a conclusion. He's talking again about why shouldn't we use this cheese? Okay? Back to the cheese. Okay?
It's very nice, but it's a little difficult to see the connection.
Right, right. That is, you have to make a transition here and there and everything else.
That wasn't exactly a smooth
transition. No, definitely not. Definitely not. But he says, okay. He says, oh, my Tama, why? For what reason? And he says, Oma Ula, because Ula said, the Tema Rab Shmuel Bar Abba. Another saying that was Rab Shmuel Bar Abba. Remember, we always want to make sure that we know who is the author of the statement, right? He says, Gezeiro Kadosho Hi, the Yem Mefak Bekim Bot. This was a brand new decree that they gave not to use Goyish cheese. This was a new decree.
What?
It was a new decree.
Yeah. Of what?
Not to use Goyish cheese.
Goyish cheese.
Okay. And you're not allowed to even question the reason for the decree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now they want to know, my Gezeirosa, so tell me, why did they make such a decree? So Amar Rav Shimon ben Pazi, Amar Rav Yeshua ben Levi, so Rav Shimon Pazi said the name of Rav Shimon ben Levi, he said, Mishum Nikur. You know why? He says, because of the fact that they're back again to our old friend, the snake.
Our old friend, the snake.
The snake likes the milk, and what does he do? He drops some poison into it, and so therefore, in order to make sure that we don't eat poisoned cheese, okay, so that is the reason for it. Okay.
Huh?
Or mefakpek?
Mefakpek.
Well, usually mefakpek means to be doubtful about something.
Okay.
Right. Right. But here it means, you know, don't even ask any questions about it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, this is according to Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, okay? So it says, Malay Malay. So why can't he answer him? Mishum Nikur. I mean, alright, so why didn't he say it before, right? Kidu'ula. Rather, we have to go back and say that the reason for the prohibition is as Ula explained. The Omar Ula. What did Ula say? He says, Kigazru Gizayrosa Baba Rova Lo Megalat Tama Atresa Yachi Shata. In Eretz Yisrael, Marova means Eretz Yisrael, right? In Eretz Yisrael, when they make a gezerah, a decree, that, you know, this and this is prohibited, you understand? Then they do not reveal the reason until a full year has passed. Why? Dilma ika inish delo savale, because maybe there are people who are not in agreement with this. They don't accept it as being logical. They all say the zulzulebor, and guess what? They'll come and you know they'll treat it with contempt. Okay, so therefore, what they have to do in Eretz Yisrael, they make a gezeira, they make a decree. They don't say why they make it the decree. They just say from now on you're not allowed to do this or that. Right? Not allowed to eat trefa cheese. Okay, and then by the time that a full year has passed. Then in that particular case, you know, Treyasayarche is 12 months, Shata, a full year, right? By then, the people already have accepted it, and they'll take it as a matter of course. Okay. All right.
It seems to me, though, that people didn't accept like it, they would fight it.
Yeah, right. Obviously, they must have had some reason, which here is not explained. Is it really because of Nikur? They're afraid of the snake? Or are they afraid of something else? I mean, they didn't really explain what it was. But as I said, I think I'll stop at this point simply because I'm a little bit tired tonight.
So what are we under this ruling from eating now? What particular...
Well, we follow the practice that if the cheese is not Cholav Yisrael, right? In other words, that it has a hafshah, and in that particular place, we don't use that cheese. Okay? Now, I said Cholav Yisrael. It's lav dafka Cholav Yisrael. I have to explain to you. In the making of cheese, there are two sources. One is regular milk, and the other one is milk which has been milked on the supervision of a Jew. So if you'll take a look at the package of the cheese, they could both be kosher. Understand? They could both be kosher. Because inasmuch as in America, we accept the fact that milk in general, you know, being under strict government regulation and so on, so we could use it. And that's the reason why, I mean, We accept the woods, guided, and so on and so forth. One that has an IOU, another one that has a VH on it, and so on. But the point is that all these rabbinical organizations agree that this milk, even though it is not Cholav Yisrael, it hasn't been milked, you know, with a kosher supervisor standing over the cow at the time when it was done, you understand? It's acceptable, and you can make kosher cheese out of it, okay? But we also have cheeses where it says specifically Cholav Yisrael on it, okay? And as a matter of fact, even there are two different readings if you understand the Hebrew very well, okay? One of them will tell you that it is Cholav Yisrael Misha'atz Gibun. In other words, from the moment that they start in to make the cheese, they're using Cholav Yisrael in it. Okay?
What is the
word? Gibun. Legabe means to make cheese. Gavino.
To make cheese.
To make cheese, right. The word Gavino. Okay? Yeah, so Legabe is the verb. So, Misha'atz Gibun, for the time that they start in, you know, to curdle it and to make it and so on, okay? The other one will say, Misha'atz HaChalipa, even from the moment that they milked the cow, it was already under supervision, okay? It's like, for example, making matzah for Pesach, okay? If it's very strict matzah, then you know it will say that this wheat has been watched Mishas Katsira from the moment that they harvest it, right? So the same thing, Mishas HaChaliva. So this is the kind of cheese that we accept today. And as we mentioned earlier this evening, they are using many chemicals and vegetable rennets and things like that these days, so that they try to get away as much as possible from not having to use animal rennet in it, even though technically it would be acceptable, particularly if it were in all kosher slaughter.
Well, there are vegetarians that don't want to eat that.
Right.
They want to make sure.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not a matter of kosher, it's a matter of being vegetarian.
Yeah, right. Okay. So this is what we do today. But in those days, this one had a theory about a snake, and this one had a theory that it was Avodah Zorah, and things like that, you understand? So they had different reasons why they prohibited it. Today, we see the development, in other words, here, of the problem concerning kosher cheeses and what is prohibited, and and then you could trace it, to our own day as to what we do today. Okay. Okay, today is the 17th of the month of August, 2005. We continue with the Gemara. Avodah Zorah, Lamed Hei Omed Aleph, 35A. We're roughly about two-thirds of the way down on the daf. And the last thing that we discussed before we got into a general discussion about cheese, since we're still talking about kosher, non-kosher cheese, was the statement by Ula. What did Ula say? Ula said that Kigazre Gezerta B'Ma'arova, that in Eretz Yisrael, when the rabbis get together and they make a decree, Lo Migalotamu Atresa Yachishata. Okay, they did not reveal the reason behind the making of the decree for a whole year. Because if people will know why they do it, then in that case they'll say, well, I disagree, and they will disregard it, and so on. So that, in other words, in order to uphold the authority of the decree, therefore, in Eretz Yisrael, if they made a decree, they did not reveal the reason why they did it for a whole year, okay? And I guess they figured that by the end of the year, people already would be accustomed to it, and they would accept it, they wouldn't ask too many questions about it, okay? That's what Ula had to say. Of course, Ula lived in Babylonia, so he's talking about the decree that was given by the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. So Megadu bar Rabbi Yimya. Rabbi Yimya did not like this particular decree. Megadu actually means that he insulted it. Yes. You know what I mean? Right. He says, well, what kind of vice is this? He says, okay. Elabiyata, he says, look, now what was he objecting to in the decree? What he was objecting to was one of the theories that was advanced why they prohibit the cheese, namely what? The good old snake. The snake theory, okay? The snake deposits poison in the uncovered liquid, and as a result, in order to make sure that you're not going to get harmed. So, okay. So, he poo-poos it, okay? He says, Elamiyato, if this is the case, Yevesha Tishtori. And Yoshan Tishtori says, first of all, if that's the case, then if it is dry, let's say the cheese is dry, okay, then in that particular case, it's kosher. Why is it kosher? Because he says the snake's poison would not permit the cheese to harden. So that therefore, if it's hardened, then it shows that there's no poison inside. Okay? And the same thing with Yoshan. Yoshan means old. And according to Rashi over here, if you take a look, you see that Rashi refers it to liquids. Particularly it says Yayin or something like that. Because again, remember, what was the fear? The fear was that there were snakes And if you left liquids uncovered, the snake would come and you would leave a little deposit inside over there. Okay? So, he says, if it's old, the liquid in that case, I mean, let's say like wine, you know that there's no poison in it because, again, it would not have permitted the wine, you know, to age the way it is. The Omer Rabbi Chanina, as Rabbi Chanina said, Yoveish Mutor, right, that if it's dry, then it is permissible. Because why? Ein manicha liyavesh. Because the poison would not permit it to become dry. Okay? And the same thing, yoshan mutor, if it's old, it's also acceptable. Why? Because ein manicha liyoshan. So that it would not permit it to become yoshan. Okay. So, we've had already on this page, I've lost track of how many different reasons why not to have, you know, the gevina, the cheese of a goyim. Okay, one that maybe came from Avodah Zarah, another one that it came from the nevela, right, a treifa animal, and another one. The question is whether it was affected by any, you know, any way by being in the actual cave, being in the stomach of the animal, did it have an effect upon it or not, or was it simply perish, some substance which is completely independent of what it is. I mean, we had all these different things presented to us, okay, as possibilities. So we have another one. Amar Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina said, "Lefi she'ef shalo below tzivtuchi chalav." Okay. So what did Rabbi Chanina say? He says, "I can give you another reason why you shouldn't have it." Okay. We know that our milk that we use today, right, conforms to government standards, and we know what goes into the milk, that it has to be pure cow's milk, etc., etc. Or, I suppose, I guess you could still have sheep's milk or goat's milk, you know, but at any rate, it has to be produced under definite standards, okay? And there's not going to be any admixture of, let's say, a chazer's milk, a donkey's milk, or something like that. You understand? But in those days, they had no board of health, thank you, Beverly, to keep an eye on these things. And so therefore, maybe, you know, the goyish farmer would decide, you know, to add a few drops of, let's say, chaza milk, or donkey milk, or something like that, horse milk. I mean, there are, you think it's... I know I used to read about, I don't know, Manchuria or someplace, other than they drink a horse's milk, yak, and so on, right, yeah. So, you know, there are definitely, you know, people who drink milk from treifa animals, too. Okay. So, what was the fear? The fear is that he would add a little bit treifa milk to the kosher milk, right? And he says, "Sheefshor la beleitzik tuchei chalav." He says, and then if you have cheese, it's impossible that it should not have a few drops of the non-kosher milk within the, let's say, you know, the holes of the milk or something like that, like the sort of Swiss cheese or something like that.
Right.
Today you're using the sense of to polish something, right? Right. Correct. But here it means like drops of milk, right? Yes.
Wouldn't that though fit into the theory that you could have very much minute amounts of contamination without ruining the whole, or not?
Well, that's a good question that you're asking. But the chatchila, to begin with, we don't want to say that that would be kosher, even if it. You know, the most of the milk was kosher. there are things, again, I'm telling you, kashrus is a very, very complicated subject. Okay. One of the problems with kashrus is, again, you know, what do you do l'chatchila and what do you do b'di'evet? I mean, we've had time and again this discussion. L'chatchila means to begin with, you don't do this and this and this and this. Okay. B'di'evet means if, God forbid, it did happen, then is it possible to say that, okay, that's all right this time, but don't do it again. You understand? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a possibility. So, obviously, his feeling was that even if there was a minute amount of trefer milk in it, it would not really mix with, well with the kosher milk, and in the cheese it would come out. Okay? Shmuel Amar, Shmuel comes up with a different idea. It says, you know why? Yudnei Shema Amid and Oysor, Eor Kavis Levela. Right? So, because they put it into the actual skin of the more of the Levela, right? Of the trefa animal. So, this is his opinion, all right? That they're using the actual skin itself, and if they're doing that, then in that particular case, then it's impossible that it should not be what I said before, the, you know, earlier tonight, about the problem of nursing tom, that the skin, the fleshik, will definitely impart some sort of a taste to the milk itself, and therefore it makes it treif. Okay. Okay, so now they say, well, all right, the skin. But, okay, well, good for Sharia. So, you want to tell me now that, okay, but if it was not the skin, it was just the rennet in it, that would be okay? Asking a question, right? Would be Yomar Shmuel Hachi, so does Shmuel really say that? The Ot Nan. Didn't we learn the Mishnah which says, Keva so oivet kechovin, the rennet of an idolater, or vishal nevela, or of a trefa animal, right? Harezu asura, right? It is prohibited. The Havinin Don, then we ask the Kasha about it, it says, Atu the oivet kechovin lav nevela hi. So wait a minute, they say. Why do they have to say the rennet of an Oved Kachavim and of a Nevela, right? If it was the animal of an Oved Kachavim, right? In other words, it was an animal that was used for idolatry. So a Nevela, isn't it certainly treif? So why do they have to have two things mentioned? Both Avedis Kachavim and also the Vela. So the Omar Shmuel, and also over there, the Mishnah, Habsbi Mishnah, the Becholim. Alright. So it says over there, Chadok Katoni says it means the same thing. In other words, that what? That Taka. If it belongs to an Eved Kachavim, right, to an idolater, so his Reddit is, that it, obviously his animal is not kosher. Okay. Now, how about keva shechita zevet kachovim nevela asura? So, and likewise, the rennet, if it was a goy who shechted the animal, now he's not talking about exactly an ovet kachovim, an idolater who is sacrificing an animal to Aveda Zora. But what happens if you have a goy who decides to slaughter an animal? Is it kosher or not? I mean, can we consider it kosher? We can't, right? So this is what he's saying. Keva shita sevet kechavim is nevela, it's asura. I mean, that's grave, and it's prohibited. So you can't accept
it. You cannot use it.
No. Right, right. This is what he's saying. Okay, this is his point. Right. Okay, so now we go to the next slide over there. This is Lake Kasha. So it says, nah, not a big difficulty. We can iron out the problem. All of I.
I'm a type.
Right.
Got hope.
Okay. Didn't realize I was doing it from the paper.
The language that we're
right.
reading here,
yeah. It's a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic.
Hebrew and Aramaic.
Oh, yeah.
It's
right.
much a mixture. Because that's not the language that they're speaking today in any way. They had to
The modern Hebrew developed from all the various sources,
yeah.
beginning with biblical Hebrew, because the foundations of the grammar to begin with were biblical. Then along came the time of the Gemara, the Mishnah, okay, where they added, like for example, Hoyah, Hoyisi, etc., etc., because I'm pronouncing it Ashkenazi now since we're learning Gemara. Otherwise it would be Hayah, Hayiti, etc., together with the present tense of a verb. In the language of the Bible, that doesn't exist. If I wanted to say, you know, something either that I was doing or that I used to do time and again. In the language like Latin, you have what they call an imperfect, which is supposed to represent that idea, and so it continues even in French and Spanish and so on, the imperfect. And buffet. That means either that something that you used to do again, you used to do it, or that you were doing something like that, okay? But this, in the time of the Mishnah, that's what developed. For example, hu haya omer could mean either he was saying or he used to say. Right, okay. So that is a development that took place, and of course it's still used, construction is still used today in modern Hebrew. Okay.
But the language,
right.
because the language sounds strange in many ways, it's because of the Aramaic.
Yes, in this particular case, that's correct. Right. Of course, some of the Aramaic expressions of the Talmud have been adopted into modern Hebrew. The Kasha. I mean, that's one of these. I don't mean the cereal. I mean, that's a question.
There's still some people actually in Israel. I read an article that speak Aramaic. It must be about a half a dozen families that came from a region in Syria, and I think I know one or two of the families live in Holon, and they use Aramaic as their dinner table conversation because they speak Hebrew, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And obviously,
No, the Shomonim talk Hebrew, as far as I know. Not Shomonim.
I didn't hear that there's Shomonim.
But
and some other.
There are
peoples in the general area.
In
Iraq,
certain areas of Mesopotamia,
Syria.
Right? Yeah. Either Syria or Iraq, even you have a small minority of people who speak Aramaic even today, either Aramaic or another version called Syriac. Which is another version of
that's where I heard it. Right. The Syriac. Right. That was the other part there. In the Syrian Orthodox Church.
Right. They still use
Aramaic in their
correct.
Liturgy. That was it. That was
right.
the other part. Thank
right.
you. That was
right.
the other name.
Yeah. Right. So that's a version of Aramaic actually. Okay, so we say it's not a difficulty because it's kan koidim chazora, kan liyacha chazora. Because in one case, the Mishnah in Hulin, where it speaks over there about, you know, that the keva of a goy, an animal killed by a goy, is asura, right? So it's before Rabbi Yehoshua decided to accept it. But afterwards, so then we see that later along came the decree, and they said that you can't use it, okay?
What is he objecting to here?
Pardon me?
What is he objecting to here?
Only that there is a difference over here about what did Shmuel say? Did he say this? Did he say that? Okay? That's essentially what it is.
Right, why did you bring in the Quran now?
All right, because this idea is again repeated in the Quran. You know, we have in the Quran the laws in general, Basa Bechorim.
Yeah.
So it's brought over there too. Okay? Okay. So, I mean, this is a practicality. That's all I can tell you. Initially, Zos Ben Kaiman, you don't have to do any emendation of the initially. You know, the, today, everything, modern scholarship, you make emendations. I got the latest periodical from the Rabbinical Assembly, and it tells us how, beginning in the 1950s, it's after I long after I graduated, from that point on, they adopted officially biblical criticism as part of the curriculum. As prior to that, they did not necessarily accept it. I mean, there were individuals who accepted, but it was not the stated policy, shall we say.
So now they can criticize.
Now it's widespread. And part of biblical criticism, you know, if it's just to try to understand background, that's perfectly okay. But when they start in to change words and to say that this was written by this author, somebody wrote something else, and so on and so forth, I mean, it destroys the whole idea of the sanctity of the scriptures.
And much of the biblical criticism is done by non-Jewish.
Of course, it was started by non-Jews to begin with, right. This is why Solomon Schechter, who was the founder of the Jewish Theological Seminary, he said that a higher criticism, he said, is higher anti-Semitism. Well, it was started by Goyim, who, you know, they did everything in order to disperse the Jews. Let's continue and finish this business with the cheese. Okay. He comes up with a different theory as to why the sages prohibited the use of goyish cheese. He says, you know why? You know what they do? You have a nice piece of cheese, and what do? They take chazer fats, lard, whatever you want to call it, and they smear the surface with it.
Fat.
I agree with you, fat. Rav Chisa Omar, Rav Chisa comes along and he gets a different one. He says, "Ibnei Shemahmid and Risa B'Koinitz." Says, you know what they do in order to curdle it? They use vinegar. Now, of course, what kind of vinegar would be prohibited?
Wine.
It would be wine vinegar, exactly. So if you have wine vinegar, then you're using that to curdle it automatically. The wine itself, of course, is, you know, it's like yenessa, prohibited. Or even if it's a stam yenessa, which we discussed for several weeks. Okay. It's also prohibited.
Don't the goyim cure cheese with big crap, some kind of curing process? No, they do that now.
I don't know. I don't eat very cheese, so I don't know. All I know is that they put cheese in bread together with hamburgers.
All right.
Also,
maybe it's kosher. I don't know.
Because they curdle it with wine with it.
If they put a kosher piece of cheese in on top of a kosher piece of hamburger.
No, I think they
Rav Nachum Yitzchak Amar, he comes up with a different reason to worry about cheese. He says, "Bneishem Abin and Esa b'shraf Arla." Shraf is juice. that comes from, well, it's like this, so to speak, right? What is exuded from the fruit, okay? Now, what is orla? We know what that is. During the first 3 years of the tree, the fruit is prohibited, okay? You know, the Goyim don't worry about that. They don't observe the rule of orla as we Jews do. So that, what do they do? They'll take, let's say, the yoich that comes out of it, the, you know, whatever is used, so the juice that they have, and they'll use it also as a curdling agent. So, the worst is prohibited. Okay. Come on. And that would be an agreement, that is, Rav Nachman Yitzchak, the people would be in an agreement with a previous Kahai Tana, an earlier teacher in the Mishnah. The Tanan is what we should read next over there. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Amad bin Bishofa, Olo, also the Neshu Pere, says, if somebody, uses as a curtaining agent the juice that comes out of a fruit which is orlo, it's prohibited because it's considered as if it were actually the fruit of orlo. Now, I guess that they must be finished with their meeting over there.
Yeah.
Okay, so I feel that Rabbi Yeshua, getting back to Rabbi Yeshua's opinion that was mentioned on the other side of the page before. He says, what was the difference between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer? Ela bitkatva de gavza, about bitkatva de pera moda. What the heck is this katva over here? Katva de gavza, okay. Katva de gavza, he says, bishava yesim no aids, right? Okay. In other words, if you had sap, which comes from a tree, and you use that sap, let's say maple syrup, okay? It's a sap out of a tree, all right? And you mixed it in order to use it as a curdling agent, then in that particular case, it would not be a violation of orla. This is what he's trying to say. Because it's the tree itself, it's not the fruit of the tree. But if it's the fruit, then in that particular case it's prohibited because then the law of orla applies.
Okay.
Pardon me? No. Orla applies everywhere. It applies not only to Eretz Yisrael, it also applies to Chutz La'aretz as well. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you go and plant a tree in your backyard, so the first 3 years that the fruit grows, you can't use it. It's only beginning.
We don't know what comes in the fruit store.
We buy it because we say the majority, you understand, is not subject to it. So therefore we don't have to worry about it because in the United States or, you know, foreign countries, we don't have to worry. But if we know, for example, that the fruit is an Eretz Yisrael, there we have to be more careful because in addition to orla, there are also other things. I mean, truma is vice versa, and so on and so forth.
So are you saying that the only fruit we have to be concerned about is what comes out of Israel?
From that point of view, right.
Can we be assured that all of these Israeli oranges that are coming over here?
Well, theoretically, orla is taken, it's supposed to be subject to it. Look, again, I mean, the majority of fruit, obviously, is long past the orla stage, as far as that's concerned. Because it would only apply during the first years when the fruit is still sort of immature or something like that. But, you know, the ones that starts to grow mature fruit, then in all probability, it's already past the orla stage.
It wouldn't even do them economically to use that immature fruit.
Right.
No.
Pardon me?
Hectares?
Hectares is something else. Oh, well, that's a different story. You're talking about, no, that's nothing to do with it. You're talking about, for example, Yoshin and Chodosh. Yeah, that's a different story. That's not as far as the seeds are. That's the question about when, for example, does the wheat grow? And, you know, whether it belongs to an older year or the newer year or something like that. Because,
yeah.
Doctor, could you maybe review what you said about Orma and, you know, the United States with Chutzlah Haaretz and why it doesn't apply again? Why we
it doesn't apply simply because most of our fruits are, you know, are long past the stage where they're the first. And we have so much fruit available, you see. If you were an individual farmer, you could watch it much more carefully, I mean, than we can today. Commercial circumstances. Otherwise, they wouldn't need any fruit, period. But,
Chodesh applies to this country?
Chodesh applies everywhere. Yes. Okay? And there are some people who are very careful about making sure about it. But, yeah. It's a problem simply because of the fact.
What is that?
According to the law of the Torah, okay? If new grain grew, you're not supposed to use it until after the second day of Pesach, because at that time they would bring the omer, and at the bringing of the korban of omer meant that you could begin to use the new grain. Prior to that, you couldn't use it. So therefore, what could you use until that time? Used for the previous year, what we call Yoshin. In other words, older, the older grain. Well, just we had over here, Yoshin, you know, about the cheese.
Saying like new, the word
right, Chodesh is new and Yoshin is old, right. So there are people who are very, very careful not to do it, even though today we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. And, you know, you can't apply the business of the omer, but still they do it, okay? So, is that the hay? All right, we'll be not done. Okay. Yes, all right. Well, I come to the pyramid, right? But, you know, it's fruit, then we say definitely it's orlo, and it would be prohibited. Behind it, it's done, and therefore, in line with that, we learned another Mishnah and Orlo, which says, Rabbi Yeshua says, Shemati b'feirush, I heard very clearly, he says, Shemami b'shofa elin or b'shofa yikorin mutar, right? That if you use as a curdling agent, okay, the sap, shall we say, of leaves, or you know, what comes out of, let's say, you crush leaves and you get a liquid from it, right? Or of roots, then that's okay. That would not be a violation of Orma. But the Shraf HaPagin also, however, it is the liquid that comes out of figs, and in that particular case, it is prohibited. Because that's fruit. In other words,